some cars, a little bit of oil, and are you ready for some football? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rosendahl. It is Tuesday, today the 27th day of November. Good as always to have you along, everybody. We're going to start with a kind of a 1-2 punch on the corporate story of the week so far, anyway, because it is only Tuesday. GM's big layoff announcement, of course. President Trump made his displeasure known yesterday. He said he was disappointed. Today, though, came the or else on this story, kinda. Not long after his chief economic advisor, Larry Kudlow, said this at the White House today.
There's disappointment that it seems like GM would rather build its electric cars in China rather than in the United States. We are going to be looking at certain subsidies regarding electric cars and others, whether they should apply or not. I can't say anything final about that, but we're looking into it. Again, that reflects the president's own disappointment regarding these actions.
So anyway, right after Kudlow said that, the president followed up with a tweet making it official because, as we know, the president's tweets are official White House statements. And he said, quote, "We are now looking at cutting all GM subsidies, including for electric cars," end of quote. So there is that. There is also the Congressional Research Service, though, which said in a report earlier this month that GM is going to use up all of its electric vehicle subsidies by the end of this year. All right, so the second part of the 1-2 is more macro, and it's about the follow-on effects of last year's tax cut. The plan, according to Republicans and supporters of that tax cut, was that companies would take their tax savings and make big investments, plants, equipment, trucks, that kind of thing. Over the past year, though, there have been signs that business investment is actually slowing. See also GM's announcement yesterday. Marketplace's Justin Ho explains why that matters.
Currency trader Juan Perez at the foreign exchange company Tempus closely follows business investment, also known as capital expenditures.
Capital expenditures being a big part of creating employment. Employment creates consumption. It creates savings. So it's a sign of a healthy economy.
That's because opening up a new plant or buying a bunch of new computers can be an expensive and risky undertaking for a business. John Bai is a professor of finance at Northeastern University.
If they're buying stuff that's very hard to get rid of, that's definitely a big signal of their confidence.
And when businesses aren't confident, they're less likely to invest in a big, fancy factory. Bai says right now, things are pretty uncertain.
You know, the rate hikes, we don't know what's going on. The trade war is going on. Both, just through both channels, are making companies more reluctant to reinvest in capital equipment.
That kind of investment did go up when the tax law first went into effect, says Mateo Arena at Marquette University. But lately, the growth in capital expenditures has been slowing.
So there's a little concern because it seems like the bump from the tax reform is kind of expiring.
Data from Credit Suisse show that robust investment by S&P 500 companies in the first two quarters of the year slowed down by almost half in the third quarter. In New York, I'm Justin Ho for Marketplace.
All right, now to another equally large section of this economy, the housing market. We hear a whole lot about what it's like buying a home in this housing market. Rising interest rates are making the small housing supply out there tougher to afford. But what about selling a house? New numbers from the Case-Shiller Home Price Index out this morning show that while prices are still rising, they're growing. That is, rising at the slowest pace in about 20 months. And meanwhile, sales of existing homes do continue to fall. Not exactly a seller's market, as Marketplace's Megan McCarty-Carino reports.
Just this morning, Los Angeles realtor Hugo Torres was talking with his colleagues about sellers who have unrealistic expectations.
People think, you know, I'm going to strike it rich right now and I'm going to get very, very ambitious about my price.
So Torres says he brings them back to earth with graphs showing how houses are staying on the market longer or pulling up news stories like this one on his phone. Anything to show the market isn't what it used to be.
It is a new landscape.
In Portland, Oregon, realtor Tim Monicum says in the first half of the year, his listings would sell in a matter of days, often above asking price.
Since June, every listing have sat on the market at least a month, maybe 6 weeks before even getting offers.
Including the two-bedroom condo of his client, Jennifer Hames.
I have had a ton of traffic, but it really didn't turn out to be exactly what I had hoped.
That's because her condo still hasn't sold after 3 months. Hames says she might lower her price after the holidays. Ian Kennedy can't afford to wait it out. The Maryland resident just bought a new place in his Washington, D.C. suburb, so he's got to sell now.
We're going to price it where we think we can sell it reasonably quickly.
He just met with a home stager who liked his updated kitchen and offered hope for his prospects of selling, but he's been on the housing roller coaster before. The house he's selling? He bought it just a couple years before the market tanked in 2008. I'm Megan McCarty-Carino for Marketplace.
There is news of magazines today. Condé Nast, owner of Vogue and Vanity Fair, The New Yorker, among others, announced a big shakeup. The CEO is going, global operations are merging, and the light at the end of the tunnel, the company hopes, is profitability. Marketplace's Jed Kim takes a look at that.
For years, the conventional wisdom has been that print is dead. But not magazines, though. Rick Edmonds is with the Poynter Institute.
The magazine industry is now having, you know, its own version of the financial press that's hit newspapers for some time.
Last year, Condé Nast lost more than $120 million in ad revenue. It put its titles Brides, Golf Digest, and W up for sale this summer. Rebecca Sterner is an independent magazine consultant. She says more advertising is moving online.
You know, Vogue has websites and all sorts of other digital offerings. So the publisher is obviously trying to take advantage of those tools to gain ad revenue.
So far, that revenue hasn't yet made up for the loss of print ad buys and waning subscriptions, but the company is pushing more heavily into the digital space. Condé Nast announced last week that Glamour will move totally online starting in January, which is a risk.
Usually it's the death knell of a magazine. What Condé Nast has going for it is that Glamour is just such an enduring brand
that it might be able to survive. But Samir Hosni, who directs the Magazine Innovation Center at the University of Mississippi, says the company's leaving money on the table.
If you are going to convince me that a magazine with 2.2 million circulation cannot make money, then you are giving this magazine away.
He says the key to magazine's survival is focusing less on wooing advertisers and more on making content readers will pay for. I'm Jed Kim for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, I personally would give it a very firm meh. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. The economic data points you need to know for this next story come from the Energy Information Administration. It's part of the U.S. Department of Energy, and the data points go like this. Texas produces, as of the most recent data, 30% of the crude oil in this country. It's also home to 30% of all U.S. refining capacity, which gets us to this. When hurricanes hit Texas, all the rest of us out here in the energy-consuming economy feel it. There is a plan to protect all that industry from all those storms, but it's going to take billions of dollars and boatloads of political will and community buy-in to get done. Travis Bubenik has the story from the Marketplace Hub at Houston Public Media.
Head just a few minutes east from downtown Houston's fancy restaurants and cocktail bars, and you'll find yourself where I'm at right now, a gritty, heavily industrial side of the city filled with refineries and smokestacks. From here, you can watch tugboats push barges up and down the Houston Ship Channel, the beating economic heart of the whole region. And it's all at risk of disastrous flooding, given the right hurricane in the right spot.
It's kind of like we've dodged the bullet.
Larry Dunbar is with Rice University's Severe Storm Prediction, Education, and Evacuation from Disaster Center. The Speed Center, as they call it, has been looking at how to build something to protect the coast for years. Dunbar says Hurricane Ike, which hit the region in 2008, could have been a lot worse.
Had Ike made landfall where it was projected to make landfall, we would have seen 3 to 5 feet more water in the ship channel. That would have made some people kind of wake up.
A big enough storm could shut down Houston's industry, causing widespread fuel supply disruptions and environmental contamination. That's in part why Texas and the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers want to build more than 50 miles of levees and flood walls on the coast, along with huge storm surge gates. Dunbar says it's not enough, especially after Hurricane Harvey's historic rainfall here last year.
We are now seemingly getting bigger hurricanes than we've had before, more frequently. We know we're getting 30, 40, 50 plus inches of rain.
His team is proposing even further protections. The plan's in its early stages, and you can bet there will be plenty of debate.
We hope it's something that's good for everyone and not just the refineries and the plants.
Jeff Antonelli owns the Shrimp and Stuff restaurant in Galveston, an hour south of Houston, where the barriers would be built. He worries how that would impact tourism and life in general.
Still, after Ike, he thought hard about his future and decided the coast needs some kind of defense.
Is this a place where my kids and their grandkids are going to, is it still going to be here if we get hit by these? You know, because whether you believe in climate change or not, I mean, this is a fact that I've lived.
Concrete infrastructure is not this surefire way that we're going to have protection.
Jordan Maka is with Bayou City Waterkeeper, one of a few local environmental groups that agree the region needs protecting, but worry the Army Corps is trying to build its way out of the problem.
We have not really seen anything that is a true comparison to what they're proposing.
The Netherlands has built huge storm surge gates before, but the Texas project would likely be bigger. Maka's group wants more details on how the gates in the water would affect things like oysters, shrimp, and fish.
Particularly in an area that relies so heavily on these ecosystem resources for its livelihood, we shouldn't be flippant to say, yes, we know that we need protection and we'll take whatever we can get.
The plan does include ecosystem restoration projects like improving beaches and sand dunes to make the coast more naturally storm resistant. And the Army Corps says there's room for modifying the plan. Everything from the scale and the design of the barriers to the way environmental impacts are managed could still change. The project is estimated to cost around $32 billion. One big challenge, convincing Congress to approve that. In Houston, I'm Travis Bubinick for Marketplace.
Predatory lending is not a new concept in this economy. Companies pushing right up to the letter of the law or regulation, convincing consumers to take on debt they maybe can't afford at terms that overwhelmingly benefit the lender. That is the standard version of predatory lending, right? But a pair of stories on Bloomberg the past couple of days are shedding some light on a twist, I guess, on that model, one that is hitting small businesses across the country. Zach Mider has the byline. Zach, welcome to the program.
Glad to be here.
Seems to me the first thing we ought to do when talking about these two stories is define a term, and that term is confession of judgment. What does that mean?
Sure. So it's an kind of ancient legal instrument where it's almost like pleading guilty in a criminal case, only this is in a dispute about debt. So you basically go into court and say, I admit that this judgment against me is valid. I owe this money. And the way it's being used here in the stories we're working on, these lenders are requiring their customers to sign one before a loan is ever made so that if something bad happens later on and they need to go to court to collect, they already have a court judgment they can use. So there doesn't have to be a trial or a hearing or any evidence or notice to the defendant. They just have a judgment in place that they can use to collect.
And so you're cooked. I mean, you're done, right? If you're on the wrong end of this thing, you're done.
Well, it gives the lenders the ability to go after your assets, especially your bank accounts. They're going to go in and try to take all the money out of your bank as soon as they can to try to collect on the judgment that they have against you.
And this is now, at least as laid out in parts one and two here, it's a New York-specific thing.
New York law is kind of uniquely friendly to the filings of these confessions. And the whole industry, the merchant cash advance industry, has kind of decided to use New York as the place. They make all their customers sign a New York confession, and then if something goes wrong, they claim something goes wrong, they go to a New York county clerk, have them sign the document, and then go ahead and collect and raid the customer's bank account.
Merchant cash advance is at the crux of this thing, right? It's businesses who, for whatever reason, haven't been able to get a conventional bank loan and so have had to resort to not payday lending, really, but kind of.
It's kind of like payday lending for small businesses.
Right.
During the financial crisis, banks were kind of pulling back on lending, and the cash advance industry kind of stepped into that void and is now a pretty big industry, maybe $15 billion last year, according to one estimate.
There's an anecdote in part one where this woman running a small business, I think it's Florida, basically gets a phone call. Lay that out for me.
Sure. So Janelle Duncan runs a real estate brokerage in Florida.
Yeah.
They have a loan from one of these merchant cash advance companies. And she gets a call kind of out of the blue saying, these people are coming for you and they're going to take all the money out of your bank. And she basically thinks it's a scam. She's like, who is this guy? Why is he calling me and warning me? And it turns out everything he said is exactly right. A couple days later, their bank account was frozen. And then later, more than $50,000 was taken.
Completely legally.
Yeah. I mean, mostly legally anyway, the basic structure of using these confessions of judgment in New York and then having the New York City Marshal kind of grab the money out of people's banks all around the country is one that the courts have not objected to so far.
Give me a sense of scale here, would you? Before 2014, one of the charts in your piece yesterday, before 2014, there were like 15 of these judgments ever. And since then, it has exploded, is not an exaggeration.
Yeah, we calculate that right now, these companies are filing about 1,200 of these things a month in New York courts. In many cases, that leads to bankruptcy or the business having to shut down because they can't continue to operate.
Say that again. These businesses who basically without recourse have lost their assets, they're fundamentally done.
In many cases, there are. In Janelle Duncan's case, it led to their business ultimately declaring bankruptcy and shutting down. For a small business to lose access to your bank account and all the money in it, you can't make payroll, you can't pay vendors. It puts you in a really tough spot.
It's funny. It's one of those where it's not what's illegal that's crazy, it's what's legal that's crazy, right?
That's exactly right.
Zach Mitre, kind of an amazing piece in Bloomberg the last couple of days. Zach, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Coming up.
You do start to ask questions. What is and what constitutes a sellout?
Spoiler alert, it's not actually selling out all the tickets. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's up 108 today, about 0.4%, closed to 24,748. The NASDAQ basically flat, finished at 7,082. The S&P 500 up 0.8%. Ended to 26.82. United Technologies said it's going to split into three independent companies. The conglomerate plans to keep its aerospace business. Otis Elevator and Carrier Air Conditioning divisions are getting spun off. Split's expected to be completed in 2020. United Technologies, though, cooled off 0.4% today. Sales of Teslas in China dropped 70% in October compared to a year ago. The China Passenger Car Association says Tesla sold 211 cars in China last month. Why, I hear you ask? China raised its tariffs on imported cars to 40% in response to U.S. tariffs. Two words, peeps. Can you say trade war? You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We did domestic oil a minute ago, storm barriers in Houston. Now the international market. There's a corruption trial going on right now in Milan, Italy, that could, depending on how things turn out, change the way that big oil gets drilling contracts in what are usually resource-rich but geopolitically poor developing economies. Royal Dutch Shell and the Italian state oil company Eni, two of the biggest oil companies in the world, are accused of bribing Nigerian officials to get an offshore drilling contract there back in 2011. The thing is, according to the corruption watchdog Global Witness, those contracts are notoriously and intentionally opaque. From the Sustainability Desk, Marketplace's Scott Tong has that story.
The oil deal in question is known as a production sharing agreement between Nigeria and the two oil companies. Normally, the country with the oil gets 65 to 85% of the revenue, as recommended by the International Monetary Fund. Not here, says Barnaby Pace of Global Witness.
This deal that Shell and Eni negotiated in 2011 nets Nigeria just 41% of the revenue, wildly favorable to the company in this case.
He says the deal shortchanges Nigeria by nearly $6 billion over the life of the contract. Pace says in most oil deals, the country gets taxes and royalties and a portion of the actual oil.
However, in this deal, Nigeria will get no share of the oil at all.
The oil, gas, and mining sector is the world's most corrupt, according to the Organization of Economic Cooperation and Development, a group of the world's richest countries. Shell and Eni are now on trial, accused of giving $1.1 billion in bribes to get access to the Nigerian oil. Already two middlemen have been sent to jail. In statements, Shell and Eni rejected the Global Witness report and declined to comment on the trial. Thomas Fox is a compliance lawyer who spent decades in the oil business. He says the Nigeria transaction could well be above board.
The payment of $1.1 billion could be seen as a prepayment where they got a discount on the back end. So that could be the business side argument.
Still, he says the deal looks highly unusual and that most contracts like this use a standard form. For all of Nigeria's oil riches, 80% of the people there live on less than $2 a day. And $6 billion could go a long way in public health spending, says Edwin Okoria. He's Nigeria rep at the One Campaign, an anti-poverty group.
As we speak right now, 2,000 kids die daily on average. And then the country will lose $6 billion when there are no clinics, there are no hospitals at the community level that people could attend. All these deaths are coming from preventable diseases.
Wall Street analysts say other potential losers are investors in the oil companies, who should have known the details of a deal that could now go sour. But more transparency is starting to come. More and more countries require drilling and mining companies to disclose payments they make to governments for natural resource investments. Sebastian Spio Garbra advises firms investing in Africa.
We're in an era where one has to assume that whatever agreement you agree in private should stand the light of day, so to speak.
Except perhaps in the United States. The Trump administration, in its early days, canceled rules requiring oil companies listed on the New York Stock Exchange, like Shell and Eni, to disclose more financial info. Info such as production sharing deals. In Washington, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
We're in week 13 of the NFL season. The playoff picture is just about starting to shape up, and the odds are that all of those playoff games are going to sell out, or they're going to be called sellouts anyway, because figuring out whether a professional sports game actually is sold out is way less straightforward than you'd think it ought to be. Marketplace's Andy Euler explains that one.
Thanksgiving Day, Dallas and Washington battled for first place in football's NFC East. The Cowboys say more than 90,000 people were at this game. Washington fan Ben Jones was there, decked out in a burgundy and gold poncho. Jones says he takes attendance numbers like that with a grain of salt.
Well, whichever number's higher, this is whichever one, you know, they want to say is, you know, like, oh, look, we sold more tickets, but nobody came, but we'll call that a sellout. Or not that many tickets were sold, but a bunch of people came, so we'll call that a sellout. You know, it's like whatever looks better for their stats, I guess.
Jones is right. Teams across all sports leagues can basically say whatever they want because there's no standard. Andrew Zimbalist, a sports economics professor at Smith College, says there are only a couple of ways teams get at that attendance number.
Two most basic techniques are what's often called the drop count or the turnstile count, the number of people who go through the turnstiles. Another is the number of tickets sold.
Zimbalist says ticket sales will generally be higher than turnstile count, but not all the time. If a team dishes out a lot of free tickets to VIPs, player family members, and the media, then turnstile count could be higher. And sometimes that highest number seems like it just can't be right. Maury Brown runs the research and analytics company BizBall. He says sometimes teams will announce a sellout crowd when people watching the game at home can clearly see empty seats.
So if it's a full sellout, but you didn't meet max attendance or you weren't fully attended, you do start to ask questions. What is and what constitutes a sellout?
Here's the answer to that one. A lot of times, all the tickets are sold, but sometimes season ticket holders just don't show up, or ticket brokers like StubHub and SeatGeek buy up those tickets and can't sell them. But those empty seats aren't going to stop sports teams from telling you all about that sellout. The reason for that, says Brown, marketing.
Can they be doing something that's somewhat nefarious and trying to go around and make it look like it more than it isn't? Sure.
There's something else really weird that goes on. Sometimes teams report more people at a game than what the stadium is supposed to hold. For playoff games, for instance, many teams sell standing room only tickets. So if their capacity numbers only count the seats in the stadium, the number of fans could be more than the number of chairs. Andrew Zimbalist at Smith College says the reason for that? Pretty simple.
Well, you sell tickets. And for the postseason, the standing room only ticket could be several hundred dollars. And yes, you sell concessions as well. So this is about money, as is everything else in professional sports.
Back at the Dallas and Washington game, the Cowboys called the game a sellout, even though the team reported 92,076 people in attendance. Official capacity at AT&T Stadium? 100,000. In Arlington, Texas, I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
The This final note on the way out today, more of a curiosity than anything else, really. According to the official Chinese state newspaper, China Daily, Alibaba founder Jack Ma, one of the richest people in the world, is a member of the Chinese Communist Party. Cognitively dissonant, perhaps? Interesting, yes. Shocking? Not really. That's just kind of the way things work over there. All right, we're going. Dow Industrial's up about 108 points today, 0.4%. NASDAQ basically flat. The S&P 500 up 0.8%. Our digital team includes Sarah Menendez, Tony Wagner, and Joanne Griffith. Ben Hethcote is our digital visual producer. Sarah Muti is the executive director of digital. Sitar Nieves is the executive director of On Demand. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.